In the days and weeks that followed, I began to see more of Milne, and less of Ian and Harriet. One evening, after we had taken part together in one of the fraternity rituals, Milne asked me, "Why do you come to the meetings of the fraternity? What are you looking for?" Had I not by then read all round the subject, I might not have happened on the answer he sought. But there was one word that I had kept returning to in book after book. "Mastery," I said. "Real knowledge and final mastery." He smiled, not altogether attractively, and I knew I had said the right thing. Meanwhile, at work, my seminars grew increasingly complex and riddled with obscurities, and one by one, both students and staff began to absent themselves. By now, my interest in the occult had passed from the academic to the personal. Ian came to see me one blustery day at the end of April. I let him in and said I would put on a cup of tea. I could guess what lay ahead. A tirade against Duncan Milne, dire warnings about the company I was keeping, advice about my health. He was in the living room when I returned with the tea. His coat and scarf lay across the back of a chair, about the only free space available. He was in clerical dress. "Look, Andrew," he said, "you may as well know, Ferguson isn't going to recommend the renewal of your contract after July. You just haven't been doing the work you were contracted to do, and what you did at first was excellent, but you've allowed yourself to get sidetracked." "It's research all the same," I said. "No, Andrew, it's not. Not any longer." There was a knock at the door. Glancing at the clock, my heart sank. It could only be Duncan. The moment he came in, I could tell he noticed Ian's dog collar. The two of them looked at each other like old enemies meeting on neutral ground. "I'm just on my way," said Ian. "Thanks for the tea, Andrew. Remember to get in touch if you have a moment." He got up abruptly and went out. As he went through the doorway, he turned to wave goodbye, and I saw that his face seemed troubled. That evening, after our studies, Duncan and I spoke for the first time of personal matters. He told me that his father had been a doctor, and that his family's wealth had come from his grandfather, a cloth importer, who had traded with the Levant and North Africa. He told me he'd once been married, and that both his parents were dead, his father in a shooting accident, his mother of cancer. It was that which prompted me to speak to him of Katrina, though I had at first vowed never to do so. He listened to my story with sympathy, and I thought the sensitivity of one who has known what it is to lose someone near. At his request, I showed him a photograph. He looked at it slowly, saying nothing. His fingers caressed its surface gently, with a soft rotating motion. He whispered something beneath his breath, then handed it back to me. "What did you say just now?" I asked. He shook his head. "Not now," he said. "Later, when it is time." As I put the photograph back in my wallet, he asked a curious question. "Do you have any photographs of her grave?" I shook my head. "Well, it never occurred to me to take any," I said. "It's not really something I like to be reminded of." "But you visited?" "On anniversaries and the like, yes, I do." "Well, the next time you go, take a photograph for me. I would like to see where she's buried." He folded his hand on his lap and looked at me intently. "I make a journey every summer to Morocco. There are people there I have come to know, extraordinary people, whose knowledge I value above any other. Holy men, masters of the wisdom you and I have been studying. This year I want you to accompany me. You will see things you have only dreamt of, meet people you would never ordinarily meet in a lifetime. You have made remarkable progress in your studies, but you still have only touched the externals. In Morocco, you will begin to taste the fruit. Morocco will help prepare you. Early in June, I made a special visit to Glasgow, to the cemetery where Katrina was buried. I brought a small camera with me and took several photographs. The stone had a neglected air. Katrina's parents lived in Aberdeen now, and they visited the grave infrequently. I cleaned it as well as I could, but it seemed no less dismal to me. When I showed the photographs to Duncan, he seemed pleased. He asked if he could keep one, and although I thought it strange, I said he could. We left at the beginning of July, flying from London to Casablanca. The next day, we travelled by train to Rabat, the capital. I was to learn throughout that long summer that Morocco was not a country to be entered all at once, or apprehended in a single week. I came to it slowly, by degrees, from city to city, guided at all times by Duncan. We moved to Tangier, to a small house in the Rue Ben Risouli, near the Petit Soco. At night, when it was cool, Duncan and I would sit in a small courtyard scented with bougainvillea and read crabbed Arabic texts by the light of an oil lamp. One morning, I received a letter from Harriet, sent to the Poste Restante in Tangier. "Ian is ill," she wrote. "He fell ill a few days after visiting you. The doctors say they don't understand what's wrong. His symptoms don't correspond to anything they're familiar with. Their tests show nothing conclusive. Their drugs have no effect. Sometimes the fever passes, and he's clear-headed for a day or two. Then the headaches start again, and he has hallucinations. He insists I try to reach you. There's something he wants to tell you. He won't say what it is. I think he's afraid for you. I think there's something he knows about Milne." She had started to write something else here, but had scratched it out and begun over again. Her handwriting was shakier than before. "Last night, there was something waiting at the foot of the stairs. I don't know what it was or when it will come again, but all the time it waited, Ian's fever was high, and when he regained consciousness, he asked if it was still there. I didn't see it, but I heard it. Andrew, come if you can, but be quick about it. He's growing weaker every day. I think he cannot have long left if you do not come and reassure him that all's well. Harriet." Duncan and I set off for Fez the following morning. Well, I had come too far to turn back now, and frankly I was afraid of what he might do if I told him that I had to rush to a friend's bedside. The best thing to do would be to write or phone Harriet once I got to Fez. The city folded its withered arms about us, very dark and very old, its walls crumbling, its paving stones cracked and misplaced, its noises and smells unutterably alien to me. I kept close to Duncan, who walked along with the nonchalant gait of someone who has returned to a place he knows well. At last, we came to a plain doorway at the end of a derb, one of the innumerable short cul-de-sacs that branch off the main alleys. We knocked at the heavy door, and minutes later it was opened and we were shown inside. A curtained doorway led to a flight of unlit wooden stairs, at whose top we found a long wood-panelled room. I could see very little at first. The only light came through the tall latticed windows that looked out onto the courtyard from which we had just come. A voice came from the far end of the room, a thin, cold voice. "Takarabu, Yarufakai. Come close, my friends." Duncan went ahead of me, confident as ever. He had been here before, he knew what to expect, and whom. I followed a couple of steps behind him, straining to see more clearly in the muted light. Slowly, my eyes were growing used to the dimness. On a low divan, at the head of the room, sat an old man. When I say that he was old, You must not think I mean 70 or 80 years old. He was visibly much, much more ancient than that. He wore traditional dress, and at first I thought he might almost have been a mummy wrapped in the robes of an 18th century sheikh. Long, desiccated fingers lay like claws on his lap. A thin white beard straggled down towards a narrow chest. The cheeks were hollow, the mouth devoid of teeth. But the eyes were as full of life as any I had ever seen. "Feidlu Glesu," he said, falling into the colloquial. "Please sit down." We sat on the carpet in front of him, crossing our legs. He took his eyes from me and looked at Duncan, smiling. It was an ugly, misshapen smile. They began to talk rapidly in Moroccan Arabic, excluding me. I heard my name mentioned more than once, though I could not understand what they said about me. The old man looked at me each time, then away again. I did not return his gaze. There was a brief silence. Then I heard the old man speak again, and I knew this time he was addressing me. I could not grasp all he said and turned to Duncan for help. "He asks if you are a merchant or a seeker. It's what he once asked my grandfather. Angus Milne came to Fez to trade in cloth and left a seeker after true knowledge." I looked at the old man. His eyes had not once left me. "Ana Talib al-Haq," I answered. "I have come in search of the truth." "Mahma Khalif alam?" I did not understand. I looked at Duncan. "He is asking you, will you carry on the search, whatever the price?" I felt confused. "Oh, you know I have no money, Duncan. I can't afford to..." "He does not mean money. Perhaps I did not translate well. Whatever the sacrifice, whatever may be required..." "Well, that would be nearer the mark." I felt uneasy. What did the old man want from me? What might he demand in future? I did not even know who he was. "You must trust him," Duncan said. "You must put yourself in his hands if you are to find what you are looking for." I turned to face the old man. There was so little flesh on his cheeks he might have been dead, but for the eyes. "Nom," I said, "Mahma Khalifa." "Yes, whatever it costs." He looked at me and smiled. I felt a little sick, watching that little toothless mouth contort itself. But I had come this far. I could not turn back. The next moment, the mouth opened, and the old man spoke again, except that the voice was not his voice. "Is this all there is, Andrew? Please tell me. Tell me there's more than this." It was Katrina's voice. They were the last words she had ever spoken to me.